holding a bowl. This man sat beside Alex and patiently fed him a thick, orange liquid. Between spoonfuls, Alex looked around, counting 10 men coming and going around the fire. At least 2 watched him like it was their job, and all were armed with daggers and curved swords. The soup was made from some kind of stewed fruit, a bit like a tart peach, and when it was gone, he only knew he wanted more. Another few sips of water was all they would give him. His stomach full, Alex's eyelids drooped with the need to sleep. Real sleep this time, not just unconsciousness. The last thing he felt was his wrists being tied together. Twice before daybreak, he was half awakened and given more water. When the sun came up, Alex was feeling nearly human again. Throughout the day, they fed him doses of the tart concoction, which had a bizarre herbal aftertaste from something the cook started adding. Alex had to trust that the desert men were experts at treating his condition. He was certainly feeling better. The muscle cramps had abated, and he wasn't always thirsty. By evening, he was permitted to eat a few solid foods. Afterward, they took him to a pool of water at the center of the trees, where he was allowed to wash himself, at least as well as he could with his hands tied. Early the next morning, Alex was given as much water as he wanted to drink, and some of the thick porridge the rest of the men ate for breakfast. He had to drink his portion rather than use utensils, as they wouldn't untie him, though he asked. With some trepidation, he watched them pack up the camp. Would they make him walk barefoot and bareheaded, or would they leave him here? He wasn't sure which would be worse. Then Alex saw his sword belt among their things. He couldn't remember if he'd gotten it off before collapsing, but if they knew it was his, it marked him as a warrior. No wonder they didn't trust him. The man he'd picked out as the leader of the group approached, carrying an armload of leather clothing. They'd found his abandoned jacket and boots. Alex wondered how far he'd gotten without them. Everyone looked impatient to go, and thankfully, they untied him long enough for him to dress himself. Though he knew it wouldn't matter after a mile of walking, Alex took a little extra time shaking sand out of his socks to give his chafed wrists a respite. Before putting on the headscarf made from Cassick's shirt, he tore a few wide strips of fabric from it and wrapped them around his wrists, then offered his hands to the man waiting to bind him again. Damoran army policy was not to be a compliant prisoner of war, but these men had saved his life, and he was grateful. When all was ready, they returned one of his canteens to him. Empty, he had to go to the spring to fill it, and headed into the rising sun. Chapter 69. Baneth allowed Sage and Nicholas to roam the camp freely, but she knew their every move was watched. They spent the first day orienting themselves and watching the posted guards. She had no desire to escape at the moment, but she had to be ready, just in case. All the tents were set in an orderly manner, and Baneth's was by far the grandest. Most were large enough to house 4 to 6 men, though, and the preferred design was circular, around a central pole. They radiated from the spring-fed lake, which was round, but the wave of the dunes made the area of plants grow in a teardrop shape. Shortly after sunrise on the second day, Sage and Nicholas witnessed Kazmuni combat exercises. They stood on the edge of the training circle, observing the men spar without weapons. She watched in awe, unconsciously adjusting her feet in the sand in imitation of the stances. Baneth slipped up behind them, but her attention wasn't so focused that she didn't see him approach. She turned and bowed with her hands crossed over her chest, and Nicholas followed her example. Before the king could say anything, she waved her hand at the pairs in the ring. "This is beautiful," she said in Khimasar, glad the shared language gave her more words to use. His eyebrows shot up. "Beautiful was not the word I expected." Her gaze was drawn back to the fighters. "The moves are smooth like water, but fast like lightning.
Damoran fighting is different?
I cannot speak for your weapons fighting, but with respect to this, yes. Our fights are heavier. Does this make sense?
Baneth nodded.
It is a style we call Toshevar. It roughly means whip strike for its lightness, flow, and speed.
Toshevar, she repeated. A lovely name. This time she used Kazmuni words. The king stepped into the training ring and offered her his hand.
Would you like to learn?
He asked, also in his own language. Sage didn't even hesitate. Baneth led her a few steps away from Nicholas and took a fighting position. She stepped up beside him and mirrored it, then looked back to the king's unreadable expression.
Let us begin, he said.
Her willingness to learn opened some kind of door within Baneth. He spent the whole morning teaching her the basic stances and moves of Toshevar, as well as the words for them and the body parts they involved. She also picked up the terms for quickly and slowly, pointed and blunt, forward and backward and sideways, and several others. When the training session broke up, Baneth led her and Nicholas around the camp, giving her more Kazmuni words for things they saw. He was a natural teacher, unable to hide his satisfaction in helping her understand. When they stopped at the horse paddock, Baneth explained that soon the semi-permanent pen would be all that was left of the oasis. Sage silently theorized the spring was fed by an underground river flowing from the mountain snows of the Catrix to the west. Perhaps it also created the Dremshada, the water sand they had encountered.
The spring here is the largest and will remain for several more weeks, he said in Kimisar. But it is not the only one we must rely on to cross the desert.
Where will you go from here, Palandret? She asked.
To Ostiza, the capital city. It lies many days to the south and east.
And us? She ventured. He looked down at her.
It would please me that you should come with us to Ostiza, as my honored guests.
Honored guests? A euphemism for prisoners. That was what she and Nicholas were, for all they were well treated. She hesitated for so long that Baneth spoke again.
Darret can attempt to take you back to where he found you, if that is your wish.
Attempt?
As the springs fade, the Dremshada expand in unpredictable ways,
the king explained.
Every day the journey becomes more dangerous.
It wasn't the drying springs so much as the Dremshada that made the desert impassable. I would not wish to ask Darret to risk his life twice more for me, she said, meaning it.
A true friend would not,
Baneth agreed. The king was trying to make it seem as if they would go with him by choice, but whether that was for his benefit or theirs, she wasn't sure. In the end, it didn't matter. There was no other option. Deep down, she'd known it would be almost impossible to return right away. But Sage looked away to hide the moisture gathering in her eyes. We are not important enough to be honored guests, she said at last, but we will accept your hospitality. Nicholas had moved out of earshot and was stroking the nose of a dusty bay. Baneth stepped closer to Sage and lowered his voice.
Do not be afraid to accept this honor, Seishfaller. It is for your protection, but also because I do believe you are important.
Her stomach twisted in anxiety. Important how?
I have long wished to reconcile our nations, Baneth said. While I hoped for an ambassador or a prince to open talks with, I will not waste what I have been given to work with.
He already had one of those. To change the subject, Sage gestured to the horses. Shall we ride then to Ostiza?
Baneth nodded. We do not take horses into the dunes due to the risk of Dremshada. Men are light enough to have a chance of escape, but a horse can be buried to its neck in a matter of seconds. To the south, the ground is firmer.
He looked her up and down. Can you ride?
I can, assuming the horses are taught similar control.
And Nicholas?
Better than I, she said. When do we leave?
As soon as my last patrol returns from the west. They are already later than I expected, but then, so was Darrett.
Banneth looked at her pointedly.
I wonder if they, too, ran into De Morans and Kimisar.
Either were likely to know Nicholas's true identity. Armed De Morans could ruin the innocent image she was trying to build around her and Nicholas. But if the patrol brought Kimisar... Sage scraped a bit of dirt. Or was it blood? From the hilt of Alex's dagger with a sick feeling. The man Darrett captured had refused to speak. She wondered whether she'd be willing to silence a Kimisar who wanted to talk.
Chapter 70. The journey east was mostly silent, as far as Alex was concerned. The Kazmunis spoke among one another, but rarely addressed him. Miles of featureless desert and hours of silence gave Alex little to focus on outside his thoughts, which were mostly of her. He had to believe the Kazmunis Sage followed would have avoided the sinking sand. The number of tracks she'd met with was about 10, the same as this group. Alex hypothesized they were both patrols of some kind, which meant they would go to a central camp or village. Whether he was being taken to the same place depended on what kind of presence the Kazmuni had in the desert. He couldn't imagine anyone living in this harsh an environment permanently. But he'd thought the same about the tiny mountain hamlets high in the De Moran Catrix. In the late afternoon of the second day, Alex's group crested a large dune and looked down on a lake of clear water, shining like a diamond in the center of an eye-shaped sea of green. The Kazmuni started down the hill with a spring in their step, and Alex couldn't help catching their enthusiasm. The distance was greater than it looked, however, and night had fallen by the time they reached it. Armed sentries met them about a mile out, clasping arms and greeting as friends did. No one addressed him. Half the oasis was occupied by a camp, which Alex immediately recognized as military and non-permanent in nature. Almost everyone they passed wanted to greet the men he'd traveled with, like they'd been waiting a long time for them. Every time they paused, Alex looked around, both observing what he could and searching for signs of Sage or Nicholas. Most of the 10 peeled off and disappeared in the sea of canvas, but Alex was directed toward a grand tent nestled in the middle. He'd meet the commander of the camp right away, apparently. The ground inside was covered with rugs and warmly lit with lanterns, though the air was cool. A meal was being cleaned up from a low table, where 4 people had recently dined, judging from the pillow seats around it. The tent was large enough to house many, but there was only a lounge area with several cushions. A single partitioned section had a curtain that had been swept aside, while a servant moved around within, preparing what looked like a bed. He saw no one outside the servants. For several minutes, he and 2 of the men who'd found him waited. Alex was nearly asleep on his feet, but he wouldn't show weakness by asking if he could sit. Finally, a tall man entered the tent, and everyone within stopped what they were doing and bowed. Like the Kazmuni who had brought Alex, the man wore a single curved sword. If he was anything like the others, he also had several smaller weapons hidden in his clothes. The man whom Alex had identified as the leader of the group bowed and then spoke rapidly for a few minutes, making a report. As he was ignored, Alex took the time to study the tall man before him. He'd known enough royalty in his life to know a prince when he saw one, even without the fine trappings of the tent. The jeweled sword and scabbard he wore were not merely decorative. Their quality told Alex they were crafted for hard and frequent use. His clothes were finely made, but loose and somewhat damp. Water dripped from his uncovered black hair, as though he'd come from washing. Alex thought of the lake and hoped he'd get a chance to visit it too.
When the report was over, the prince stepped in front of Alex to peer at him. Alex met his green eyes with a steady gaze. Fear was natural in his situation, but it was not to be shown.
"One armed Khimasar in my land is curious," the man said in Khimasar. "Two is a disturbing pattern."
Alex knew his surprise showed on his face. He'd not expected to be able to communicate beyond gestures and the few phrases he'd learned. Sage's notes in his jacket contained many translated Kazmuni words, but he hadn't dared take them out in the last 2 days. Also, the Kazmuni had assumed he was Khimasar, and he wasn't the only one they'd found. Alex's mind raced. The Khimasar who'd attacked the Norsari camp wore Dumoran clothing. If the Kazmuni had captured another Khimasar, his complexion, dress, and weapons would have been similar to Alex's own. The assumption he was also Khimasar was natural. Sage and Prince Nicholas, however, had been wearing very different clothes. She, that long tunic, and he, a squire's uniform, and they were both fair-skinned and lighter-haired.
"Why did you come to Kazmun?"
the prince demanded. No matter Alex's nationality, the Kazmuni considered him a threat. If he identified himself as Dumoran now, it might make the Kazmuni prince suspicious of Sage and Nicholas when they arrived. If they arrived. Alex was also afraid of being recognized as the Dumoran soldier who'd entered Kazmun and kidnapped two men. Alex looked away. Saying the wrong thing could be fatal, and not just for him. It was better to be disassociated from Sage and Nicholas, at least for now. Sullen and silent, that's what he'd be. The prince exhaled heavily and spoke a few words in his own language. Alex half expected to be struck, but they only turned him around and escorted him out. He was taken to a tent not far from the large one, where another man lay on a rug to one side, his hands and ankles in chains. The Kazmuni now took Alex's canteen and searched him for weapons again, still not finding the pages of Sage's book tucked into the lining of his jacket. He didn't know if they'd be confiscated, but he had no desire to find out. The ropes on his wrists were removed and replaced with shackles like the other man wore. They were a little looser on the chafed areas and also allowed him to separate his hands by several inches. Once he was secure, Alex and the other man were left alone, which struck him as sloppy. But his chains were staked to the ground, and outside, the camp bustled with activity. He'd have a hard time escaping, even with the lockpick he had in the sole of one of his boots. And if he did get away, where would he go? Alex shifted into a more comfortable position on the rug they'd given him, and looked the other man over. His hair was black as Alex's own, and his complexion as tanned, though it was difficult to tell, as filthy as he was. Alex imagined he looked just as bad. The clothes the man wore were Dumoran in style, with military attributes. It wasn't difficult to deduce this was the other Khimasar they'd picked up. The man's blue-gray eyes were clouded with fever.
"Where did they find you?"
he asked in Khimasar.
"In the sands. You?"
Alex replied in the same language.
"Near the river. They came out of nowhere."
He suddenly looked hopeful.
"Why were you in the desert? Did the captain send you after me?"
The man assumed Alex was part of the same unit, meaning the Khimasar either had large numbers or hadn't worked together much.
"No," he said. "I was tracking the prince. I lost him, though."
The man stared at the roof of the tent as it waved with the desert wind.
"I should have stayed in that mountain village," he said with a sigh. "I had food. I had work. I might have had a girl someday."
"I heard a bunch of Khimasar came through Jovan last year. They raided some and disappeared."
"Is that where you were?"
Alex asked.
"In the mountains?"
He nodded.
"For the whole 9 months. Never saw anyone else until the captain called us back together. How about you?
Things were making sense now. The Khimasar had been trapped on the wrong side of the mountains, so they'd dispersed and hidden in the general population.
I wandered a bit, wintered in the valley. Didn't see much of anyone else either.
Alex leaned back on the tent pole and pointed to the man's side.
What happened to you?
His clothes had been rinsed some, but they'd obviously been soaked with blood.
Happened when they caught me, the Khimasar said bleakly. Hurts like hell, but the bleeding finally stopped. May I see?
Alex scooted closer, and the man shrugged and opened his jacket and raised his shirt. A sickly, sweet smell came from the oozing wound in his side. Alex shook his head.
Looks bad. I think it's infected.
The man shrugged apathetically and dropped the clothing back over it.
Have you showed the Kazmuni?
Alex pressed.
They treated me. And you let them?
The man looked disgusted.
I was unconscious most of the time.
Alex shifted from what had become a dangerous topic.
What's your name? Gizpan Brazko. You? Armand Dolan.
The first was a common Khimasar name, and the second was a town in Tazmit. They talked into the night, and Alex learned more of what the Khimasar had been doing for the past year. Waiting, for the most part. Their captain, a man named Malcolm Hazar, had taken command of them after last year's failed action in Tazmit, and ordered them to hide until things calmed down. When the Norsari had been formed, Hazar decided they had no more time left and called the Khimasar together.
Were you with him when he left the false trail south last year?
Asked Gizpan, yawning widely. His words were coming slower and slower. Alex shook his head, not wanting to risk giving incorrect details.
No, but I heard it confused the hell out of the Damorans. It did, though that's not hard, is it?
Gizpan laughed, then winced and breathed deeply, his hand over his side. His red-rimmed eyes closed.
I will say one thing in their favor. Their girls are pretty. Least the ones that aren't wanting to kill you.
Alex didn't have a chance to ask about the story behind that statement. Gizpan was asleep. Chapter 71. Sage and Nicholas made their way back from the lake, wearing fresh clothes and feeling cleaner than they had in months, despite not being allowed to use soap in the water everyone drank from. She and Banneth had been trying to convince Nicholas to venture with them into deeper water, when a messenger appeared and called the king away. Sage gave up coaxing Nicholas and floated on her back, working dirt and sand out of her hair, while the prince scrubbed himself with a rough cloth in the shallows. Two guards stood outside the tent, which told her Banneth was inside. They didn't try to stop the Damorans from entering, so either the message was delivered, or it wasn't anything they couldn't know about. The king sat alone at the low table, studying a map. Nicholas gave him a quick bow and went straight to their sleeping area.
Is everything well, Palandrit? She asked in Kazmuni. You left so quickly.
Banneth glanced up.
Yes, it is well. The last patrol returned, and I received their report.
Sage held her breath for several heartbeats. Did they find anything of concern, my king?
Nothing you need worry about, said Banneth.
He looked back to the map.
You should get some rest. We leave in the morning.
Chapter 72. Alex was roughly awakened at sunrise and handed a bowl of porridge. He sat up and started shoveling it into his mouth before he was fully awake. The Kazmuni guard had a little more trouble with Gizpan, but eventually he woke. As the Khimasar moved, Alex caught the smell coming from his wound. It wasn't just festering, it was actively rotting. The guard wrinkled his nose, so he must have also caught a whiff of it. He looked unconcerned, though.
My friend needs help.
Alex tried to tell him. The man didn't seem to understand him, and Alex pointed to Gispan's clothing, which was wet from the seeping wound.
"Let me be,"
said Gispan, bringing the spoon to his mouth. Alex remembered how the Kimisar didn't like that he'd accepted treatment.
"But you'll die," Alex insisted. He might even die if he was treated.
"You think I don't know that?"
Gispan took two more bites and held out the bowl to Alex.
"I'm not hungry." "Do you think less of me for wanting to live?"
Alex asked, taking the bowl.
"No," said Gispan. "I have nothing to go home to. Most of my family died in the famine, and the rest in the wildfires on the plains last year. That's why I volunteered to go into Tazmit. You obviously have a reason to live."
After breakfast, the tent was taken down around them, and Alex could now see the entire camp was breaking. Horses were being loaded, but Alex saw no wagons. He and Gispan would either ride or walk. Alex suspected the latter, and he was correct. They were chained to a heavily burdened nag near the end of the caravan. Alex watched Gispan warily. He wasn't sure the Kimisar would last long. Just before they started moving, a Kazmuni approached, carrying Alex's canteen and a waterskin for Gispan. Rather than hand them to the prisoners, the man dropped them on the ground in front of them and walked off. After that first day, the Kazmuni had been strangely distant when they gave him water, and Alex wondered if there was some kind of message in that. He picked up both, thinking Gispan didn't need anything to weigh him down. The Kimisar was talkative as he limped along, telling Alex all about his home and family, about the girl he'd set his eye on in Demora, and his love of wood carving. Most people might assume he was merely lonely after days with no one to talk to, but Alex recognized it for what it was. A dying man, realizing all his experiences and thoughts and feelings, would die with him. Gispan would feel better if he knew his memories would live on with another person, and so Alex listened. When Gispan collapsed in the late afternoon, despite having drunk all his water and most of Alex's, the Kazmuni paused to redistribute the nag's load on other horses, then slung him over the animal's back. It had to be a painful position, but fortunately, the Kimisar was unconscious. They reached a small oasis in late afternoon, and a few tents went up, including the large one, but most men opted to sleep outside. Alex sipped from his refilled canteen as he sat next to Gispan and watched the stars. Funny how the sky was the same as at home, only shifted. The northern wheel sat lower on the horizon, but the stars turned around it just the same. When the Kimisar woke, Alex tried to get him to drink, but he refused, saying he probably wouldn't be able to keep it down. The entire side of Gispan's clothing was wet and crusted with blood and fluid from his gangrenous wound. Alex didn't dare try to pull anything away to look. He knew what he'd see, and there was no reason to cause additional pain. Exhausted as he was, Alex stayed up all night listening to Gispan's labored breathing. A few times, the sound stopped, but then continued several seconds later. As the sky began to lighten in the east, the Kimisar suddenly opened his eyes. Alex scooted closer so Gispan could see him.
"Do you want some water?"
he asked.
"Yes."
Gispan rasped through parched lips, and Alex gently poured a little into his mouth.
"Thank you, my friend,"
he whispered.
"I will not forget you,"
Alex said, giving the man the last reassurance he needed. Gispan turned his face up to the fading stars.
"I wish they'd just let that woman kill me," he said. "Then I wouldn't have had to spend my last days walking through hell."
Alex sat up straight.
"What woman?"
The Kimisar didn't respond, and Alex swung his feet around and stood on his knees over Gispan to shake his shoulders.
"What woman, Gispan? When?"
Gispan
never answered. Alex insisted on burying Gizpan himself. The Kazmuni gave him a shovel, but kept a close eye on him throughout. Before Alex had even joined the army as a page, his father made it a point to teach him that enemy soldiers had thoughts and desires like any Demoran. Alex's first real fight came as a squire at the age of 15, and the experience of killing a man had made him want to give up soldiering entirely. His father told him that was as it should be. Taking the life of another human being should never be easy. Then one of Alex's friends died at the hands of Kimisar, and he felt the need to avenge him. After that, each death he delivered was progressively easier. There was always one more enemy to fight, one more injury to repay. In the years that followed, he lost count of how many Gizpans he'd sent to the spirit without thought or care. One for each shovelful of sand now, perhaps, each one taking him deeper into the pit that was his soul. As he dug, Alex played Gizpan's last words over and over in his head. I wish they'd just let that woman kill me. Then I wouldn't have had to spend my last days walking through hell. When people were dressed for the desert with their heads covered, it was often difficult to tell, but Alex had identified a few women in the caravan. Gizpan could have been referring to one of them, yet none of the women were outfitted like the Kazmuni fighters he'd seen, so Alex doubted any had been in a patrol group. My last days, he'd said. He'd only walked one day with Alex, and it must have taken several to get to the camp in the first place. Whoever wanted to kill him tried before he arrived. I wish they'd just let that woman kill me. If someone had merely argued for his death, Gizpan wouldn't have understood the conversation, so there must have been an actual attempt on his life. Had this woman been the one to injure him? Alex hadn't looked close enough at his wound to guess how it had been made, nor would it be worth trying now, after so long. The wound had been around 10 days old, though. It was entirely possible Gizpan had been picked up by the Kazmuni group that found Sage and Nicholas, which meant Sage had tried to kill him. And if Gizpan had been brought to the Kazmuni prince's camp, so had she. Chapter 73. The path Banneth's caravan took wandered to stops at various springs, but steadily took them southeast. When the king asked Sage what she knew of Ostheza, she truthfully answered nothing. But then she paused. Thes was the word for spring, and Os was seven. After thinking a moment, she asked if the city was built around seven springs. Banneth appeared pleased by her deduction. Yes. Are your cities named in similar ways? He asked in Kimisar. Some of them, Sage replied. But Demora was created by uniting three distinct cultures, four if you include Tasmet now, and the languages mingled and created a new one. The original meanings of many names were lost over time. Our people would lament such a loss. They would consider it a corruption of what was pure.
You must not like cake, then.
Banneth blinked at her for a moment.
I think you must say that again. There is a misunderstanding.
Sage briefly pulled her lips between her teeth.
Eggs are tasty. Sugar is wonderful. Oils and flour and spices are good, too. If cake is considered a corruption of their purity, then your country is missing out.
The king threw back his head and laughed, a deep, throaty sound. She knew he had a sense of humor, and had seen him smile on many occasions, but this was new to her. No one else reacted as though the king's behavior was out of the ordinary, though, so he must not always be the solemn ruler she'd come to know. He refocused on her, his eyes bright and merry.
Your point is taken, Mistress Saish.
She started to grin back, when a memory of Alex hit her hard.
They'd been riding side by side on the way to Tagan last year, and she told a story, and he laughed so hard he nearly fell out of his saddle. Not only that, but then she had laughed, probably for the first time since father died. It had taken her more than 4 years and Alex's friendship to recover. Alex had been gone less than 3 weeks. How could she have been almost happy, even for a moment? Sage abruptly turned away and feigned fixing a buckle on her saddleback. For the rest of the day, she hardly spoke. On the 10th day of travel, there was a noticeable shift in the caravan's mood. She heard laughter and jokes she could translate, if not always understand, and even the horses seemed to be dancing in delight. Baneth brought his bright bay stallion up next to the sand-colored mare she'd been given to ride, looking cheerful. "Are we near Ostiza?" she asked him in Kazmuni. Thanks to her earlier study and 3 weeks of immersion, her grasp on the language was fairly strong, though her grammar was still clumsy, and her words occasionally wrong. "Everyone is happy today." Baneth pointed ahead, to the east.
"That is the Protector's Gate. The city is half a day beyond. We will dine in the gardens of Ostiza tomorrow."
Sage squinted at the two towers of stone in the distance.
"But the gate is too far to go before night."
The shadows were growing long already.
"We will ride until midnight to camp in the shelter of the gate," he said. "There will be songs and dancing tonight, and few will sleep."
"How long have you been away from your city?"
"Over 3 months I have been gone."
The king put his right hand on his hip and pulled the reins in closer. Body language Sage had learned to associate with preparing to have his question rebuffed. He also switched to Kimisar, meaning the conversation was likely to be complex.
"You said before that Tazmit now belongs to Demora? It was not so in our last dealings."
Events of 50 years ago were nothing Sage felt had to be hidden. Briefly, she explained how Demora became tired of Kimisara's constant attacks staged from Tazmit, not to mention desiring the strategic value of the Tagan and Jovan passes. King Raymond's grandfather had begun the campaign that eventually ousted the Kimisar and forced them back.
"The land is poor for farming, but there are quarries and mines. Mostly it serves as a buffer between us. The army keeps a heavy presence there."
Sage had planned to say more, but her stomach twisted. Tazmit duty had been Alex's primary job before he was assigned the Concordium escort last year, which he'd been rather bitter about, until it became obvious he had a real threat to deal with. And of course, it was how they'd met. She would not think of it. Baneth held his braced posture. He probably thought she'd cut herself off to prevent saying something strategically important.
"You were with the army. Does Demora have eyes on other areas that may increase its comfort?"
She knew what he meant, but she feigned confusion to gain time.
"Palandrit?"
He cleared his throat.
"Recovering lost citizens is an excellent excuse to send a significant force into Kazmun."
His green eyes focused only on her.
Sage couldn't even be sure Demora knew she and Nicholas were with the Kazmuni. If the Norsari had captured the right Kimisar, they might have learned enough and followed the river to the boat and the body next to it. Whether they would have drawn the right conclusions from there was uncertain.
She pressed her lips together before answering.
"Palandrit, I can promise if Demora does come for us, they will be armed and ready to fight. To be otherwise would be foolish."
Baneth gave a short nod of acknowledgement.
"But I have no reason to believe Demora wants to expand here. The taking of Tazmit came only after all other options were exhausted."
Baneth's fingers tapped a beat on his sword belt.
"You said, if Demora comes. You seem uncertain."
"I am uncertain. Nicholas and I may be presumed dead, or they may believe the Kimisar have us."
The king looked thoughtful.
I am sorry for your family, but we should hope for either of those. Then, when you are returned next year, it will be a happy miracle.
His hand relaxed and moved to rest on his leg. Sage was glad the questions were over, because she'd become stuck on the phrase, next year. If the Damorans had no idea where Nicholas was, his return would indeed be a happy miracle. If they did know, however, they would come to retrieve him much sooner. And when they did, they were likely to bring an army.
Chapter 74. They kept Alex outside all the time, other than when the caravan paused to rest under lean-tos in the heat of the day. There was never a good time or place to read Sage's notes or to pick the locks on his chains, and Alex wasn't sure attempting to escape was a good idea yet anyway. He'd be spotted right away, and with horses to run him down, the Kazmuni would catch him in 5 minutes. Gizpan's last words and the possibility of Sage being with the group haunted him. Alex obsessively searched the line ahead every time it came into view, but it was always so far that he couldn't focus on the riders in front. In the evenings, he scrutinized every person who passed near him. What would he have done if he did see her or Nicholas? Alex wasn't sure. But if he could know they were safe, it would give him some peace. Maybe then he could make a plan to get them out of here. After 10 days, the caravan stopped in the shadow of 2 great pillars of stone. They must have been within a day of their destination, because a bonfire was built in the center of the camp, and every piece of firewood they carried was thrown into it. No tents were set up, not even the grand one. Instead, everyone pitched lean-tos around the fire, and at last, Alex had a chance to study all the faces without headscarves. And there she was. Alex nearly sobbed with relief, then wiped his eyes and took in every detail. She sat cross-legged on a large rug directly across the fire from him, by all appearances unharmed. Though her face was flushed from sun and the heat, there were shadows under her eyes as she gazed blankly into the flames, reacting little to those around her. The Kazmuni prince sat on her right, but she didn't seem afraid of him. Nicholas was on her left, looking positively cheerful, though he threw an occasional concerned glance at her. Both wore Kazmuni clothing. It was easy for Alex to imagine their own clothes had been ruined in their escape. The two princes conversed with Sage and each other periodically, and then she'd respond, never looking upset or worried, but she never smiled either. Alex knew the look on her face. She'd worn it the first time she'd spoken of her father's death, when she struggled to talk about what she'd buried for so long. What had happened to make her wear it now? Alex wanted to stand up and shout her name, to see her run toward him across the sea of Kazmuni and throw herself in his arms. But 2 observations stopped him. First, Sage wore 2 daggers on her belt, and Nicholas, too, carried a knife. If she'd made an attempt to kill Gizpan and the Kazmuni had stopped her, Sage's capacity for violence was known. Yet, she sat next to the prince, armed with not 1, but 2 weapons, the second of which must have been returned to her by the men she helped escape. The Kazmuni trusted her, and Alex didn't dare associate himself with her now. Second, on the other side of the Kazmuni prince, sat the familiar man with a scarred face, who had every reason not to trust Alex. Chapter 75. What Sage thought was a pyramid of rock in the distance proved to be a terraced city. From the Protector's Gate, everything looked as brown as the land between them, but as they drew nearer, a mixture of reds and greens began to separate from each other. The red came from the sunburned stones the city was built with, and the green was an abundance of plant life. She'd never seen a place so obsessed with gardens. Every window had some sort of plant hanging from it. Banneth had told her, Astheza existed entirely on the springs it was named for, and the overflow was used to grow crops. The Kaz River was still several miles farther east and south, and the land between expanded in a delta of green fields from the heavy stream that flowed out of the city. Otherwise, the surrounding land was desert, leading Sage to believe the gardens were not merely decorative. They must produce food, too. Scattered groves of date palms and at least one orchard grew on the lowest wide terraces, and the air was laced with the scent of their blossoms, even at this distance. Sage closed her eyes and breathed deeply. The desert had its own stark beauty, but trees would always be first in her heart. Banneth watched her from the side as they rode.
Are your cities so green? He asked in Kazmuni.
Yes and no, she answered. Our cities are places green does not intrude, rather than one of the few places it can grow.
The king nodded.
Farther south, there are forests as wet as the desert is dry. Cities there are the same as yours, a haven from nature.
A group of mounted soldiers approached from the city. Once Banneth's traveling party was positively identified, several riders returned to Astheza at speed, and the rest escorted them to the gates. They passed through the reinforced archway and the lower terrace, and began the long, winding path up the hill to the domed palace at its peak. The king rode at the caravan's head, with Sage on his right and Nicholas between them, but slightly behind. Greenery hung down over every wall, grew from every roof. Sage's hands were drawn to touch the vines and leaves within reach. After so many weeks of desert and rocks, to be among living things again was like coming up from underwater. The people of Astheza must have been used to seeing their king come and go. They moved out of the group's way and cheered and bowed, but otherwise didn't disrupt their routines and business. Children rushed up to offer flowers and fruit to the king and his riders, but they hesitated to approach Sage or Nicholas. By their northern Damoran coloring alone, it was obvious they were not Kazmuni. Banneth reached over and tugged her headdress down. The short wisps of hair she could see were much lighter after several weeks in the sun. She must look as blonde as Queen Orianna to them. At the king's gesture, Nicholas also pushed his hood back, revealing the light, coppery shade of his own hair.
Was that wise, Palandret? She whispered, as the children around them fell silent and gaped. To show them who we are without warning?
Banneth waved and smiled to the growing crowd.
They were already talking and speculating. Best to let them see.
He turned to her.
I do not want anyone to think I am hiding you.
Whether or not it was his intention, Sage was reminded she and Nicholas were the first Damorans these people had seen in 3 centuries. She represented her country, and first impressions were crucial. Her posture straightened, and her mouth curved into what she hoped passed for a smile.
Thank you, Sage said, accepting the flower one child finally dared to approach with. How lovely. You are too kind.
She never knew sitting straight and waving could be so exhausting. By the time the sloping road leveled out, Sage's arms and back wanted to wilt like the flower in her hand. Banneth led their party into a courtyard of marble columns, with a wide staircase leading into the palace. Halfway up the steps stood a young woman with her hands folded across the stomach of her crimson dress. Her long black hair fell in waves down her back to her waist. She wore a regal and dignified expression, but its effect was somewhat lessened by the child bouncing at her elbow. The rider stopped and began to dismount. The king was barely off his horse when the little girl, who looked about 8 or 9, came flying down the steps, the train of her white gown floating like a sail behind her.
Baba!
She yelled, throwing herself into his arms. Sage was too tired from her fake smile of the past hour to resist the real one that suddenly spread across her cheeks. It felt good. Banith caught his daughter and lifted her up as the woman in red came down the steps in a manner of stately exasperation. When she reached the bottom, the king extended his free arm to her, and she stepped into his embrace.
"Brother," she said, "I have missed you so."
Banith kissed her cheek.
"And I you."
He squeezed them both for a few seconds, then groaned, but did not set the child back down.
"You are getting too big for me to hold."
The woman, Chessa, princess, if she was Banith's sister, stepped back and pursed her lips.
"I told her this, but she will not listen."
"I don't know who she learned that from," Banith said, tugging the little girl's russet brown braid,
and both princesses scowled at him.
"We have guests."
He turned and gestured for Sage and Nicholas to come forward. Sage had been staring openly at the domestic scene, thinking the king was full of surprises. She'd known about a sister, but the daughter was unexpected.
"Yes, I know."
The woman waved to a servant waiting off to the side, and he rushed over, carrying a tray. Water was quickly poured and shared, and names given. Banith's sister was Alanaya, but after exchanging looks with her brother, the princess told Sage to call her Lani. The girl was introduced as Reza. Now that Sage knew their relationship, the resemblance was obvious. Banith and Lani had the same straight nose and coal-black hair, and Reza had her father's smile.
"You are most welcome here," Princess Lani said. "I look forward to hearing about your land and your journey."
"As I look forward to telling," said Sage.
Lani jumped a little.
"You are a woman."
She looked her up and down with wide eyes.
"I'm sorry I did not see that."
Sage blushed.
"My own clothes were bloodstained, torn, soiled?
Too hot,"
she finished. The princess had eyes the color of moss and earth, framed by thick black lashes, and they lit up, showing much more interest and curiosity than before.
"You must tell me about Demorin clothes, but first, come."
She turned to lead them up the steps.
"There are rooms being prepared for you."
They all followed Lani, Banith carrying Reza, who chattered so fast Sage couldn't understand more than a few words. Something about teeth, the princess pointed to a gap in her mouth, a sword, and wine. The last was said with a disgusted face. Apparently she'd tasted some and was not impressed.
"Lani," said Banith, when Reza paused for breath, "our guests will stay in Haseth's and Tomoza's rooms."
The princess stopped in the middle of the steps to stare at him, her mouth dropping open in a perfect O.
"I have baths ready in the east wing," she protested.
"It is little trouble to move them," he said.
Lani glanced at Sage with wide eyes, then turned back to the stairs.
"As you wish,"
was all she said.
Banith leaned closer to Sage. "Haseth is my son. He is away at school."
He did not say who Tomoza was.
Chapter 76.
Alex had been worried how the people on the streets would react to a chained Kimisar prisoner, but once inside the city gates, he was shuffled to walk surrounded by fighters on horseback. From inside his cocoon, he saw and heard little that wasn't several feet off the ground. They wound their way up to the top of the hill, taking a path that kept the journey from being steep, but made it very long. He was not led into the palace, but rather under it. Prisoners didn't frighten him. They always had weaknesses. Escape might finally be possible, but he wouldn't leave without Sage and Nicholas. Yet he'd not counted on such a clean prison. Alex was stripped naked, and his head and much of his body shaved. Then he was dusted with a vile powder to kill any lice that might remain. His clothes were tossed onto a cart and taken across the antechamber to a furnace. He felt the loss of Sage's notes and the letter, more than that of the lockpick in his boot. It was almost like losing her, but there was nothing he could do. They gave him patched breeches and a lightweight shirt, which Alex took his time in putting on to keep the shackles off for a few more minutes. Without his boots or the cloth strips tied around his wrists, his arms were bleeding and his ankles swelling with bruises by the time he reached his cell. The straw pallet in the corner looked fresh, and he sank down on it as the bars were closed and locked behind him. Maybe he should have revealed himself. Sage and Nicholas were in the palace above, by all appearances being treated well. If the Kazmuni trusted them, their word could set him free. Or their association with him could shatter that trust. It mattered little now. Even if he could make the guards understand he was Damoran, there was no guarantee they'd tell anyone else. Their job was to hold him. Who he was didn't matter. Alex leaned against the wall and closed his eyes. Tonight, he would rest. Tomorrow, he'd decide what to do.
Kimasar.
A rough whisper interrupted his doze.
I'm asleep, Alex replied in Kimasar. They said you were caught near Damora,
the voice said.
I was,
Alex mumbled, his words thick with sleep.
So what? Are you one of Captain Hazar's men?
The name had Alex swimming for the surface in his consciousness.
Yes. You? No, but I knew him years ago.
Alex forced his eyes open.
How did you get here?
A man slouched against the bars in the cell across from his, studying Alex with sharp, golden-brown eyes set over an oddly delicate-looking nose.
We came on a mission. Won't be here much longer.
Execution? Alex's heart pounded at the thought. Most Kimasar spies in Damora ended up on the block, and vice versa. The Kimasar shrugged.
Something like that. You got a name?
Gizpan.
You? Stesh.
He pointed his thumb at a lump sleeping in the cell adjacent.
That's my brother, Kamen.
He shifted against the bars.
So what has Hazar been doing over there?
Briefly, Alex described how the Kimasar captain had scattered his company for months and drawn them together to make an escape once the Jovan Pass had cleared of winter snow. He left out the plan to use Prince Nicholas as a hostage. Stesh snorted a little.
Always the hero. Couldn't just leave those idiots who got themselves trapped.
Still playing the part, Alex bristled.
Says the man lying in prison. I don't expect anyone to come after me if I fail.
How did you know Hazar? Alex asked.
We joined the army together at 16, said Stesh. Parted ways 5 years ago when I went into the Dolophan. Haven't seen him since, but his noble sacrifice of going back for you men didn't surprise me at all.
Dolophan were spies and assassins. No wonder Stesh expected to be executed. Alex had never had a chance to speak to one like this.
I wanted to be a Dolophan too, Alex said, but they wouldn't accept me. Never found out why.
I can answer that just by the look of you, said Stesh. You're one of those fools who thinks honor means something.
He leaned his head back and closed his eyes.
Just like Hazar.
Chapter 77
Sage almost couldn't believe the quarters they were given. While hot water was being carried in, Princess Lani showed her around the apartment, which included its own washroom with a bathtub set into the floor, a dressing closet the size of Sage's room in Tenegal, and a sitting room that could be closed off from the bedroom. Light blue and gold tapestries covered the walls, giving the rooms an airy feel, and the wide bed was adorned with an embroidered silk coverlet. Sage's hostess led her through a set of gauzy curtains and outside to a private patio that overlooked an enclosed manor house-sized garden. Around the edges of the courtyard, several other marble porches peeked through tangled vines of jasmine. Lani pointed to one across the way.
That one is to my rooms.
If Nicholas was given the prince's quarters, it wasn't a surprise to learn they were being housed in the royal family's own wing.